So my brother and I were climbing on top of our shed. We're about 12 and 10, and suddenly two stings ring out in my leg. I've been hit by a hornet. I'm stung. My brother also gets stung, and so we start crying. We're young. We jump off of the shed, run inside. We're crying at that point, and we've been clearly hit or come into contact with a hornet's nest or been close to a hornet's nest, and so there's a little pandemonium in the house as we try to figure out what's going on. I remember my Aunt Mary was visiting. She was this heavy chain smoker, so she's like, just put mud on it. Mud hits, heals hornets. They're like, okay, whatever, but there was a lot of tears and pandemonium, and my mom sends my dad outside. You got to deal with this. So he heads to the shed and does a little investigation. Sure enough, there's a big hornet's nest in the shed. Comes back, yeah, it's there. My mom's like, well, it's got to go. You got to get rid of them. So I can see my dad's wheels spinning. How is he going to go about this process? And I wish I could have talked to him, or in hindsight, talked to him about what exactly he was thinking, because the plan he came up with in hindsight seemed a little foolhardy. But his plan was this. He got a bucket and he dumped, like, I think it was like canola oil in it, some sort of oil. And so his plan was he's going to go in the shed and put the bucket of oil underneath the hornet's nest, and then he was going to knock it into the bucket and light it on fire. That was the plan he came up with. And so this was danger. He's like, hey, you all got to stay inside while I'm doing this. And I remember my brother and I sitting at the window, just right on the sill, looking, going, this ought to be good. And I can see him sort of just skirting into the shed, you know. He got the bucket right underneath the hornet's nest, and then he got his trusty bat, and watching him approach slowly. And my dad, I mean, he was just like jeans and a t-shirt, you know. I would have been dressed up in a snowsuit or something, but just watching, going, he's my dad, he can do anything, I'm sure of it. And just going in there, and then we heard a loud thud, and I just saw my dad take off like a bat out of hell, and a stream of hornets following him, and him screaming, he's getting hit, he's getting stung, gets inside the house, closes the door. We're like, I don't think that worked very well. Well, no kidding there, Dad. That memory has stayed with me because I've had to deal with hornet's nests myself, and now I put on oven mitts, goggles. That's how I approach a hornet's nest these days, take care of it. But it was weird, you know, getting rid of a hornet's nest is no easy process. In fact, in dealing with hornets, it's wise to carefully consider the best way to drive them out, because if you don't, you're going to get hurt in the process. And so back to our series on fear. Fear can be like a hornet's nest in the shed of our souls. Weak transition there? No, yeah. Anyway, could somebody Facebook that? Bread's on fire this morning. Fear's like a hornet's nest. Anyway, but I've been considering this. I've been trying to figure out, you know, this question. How do you drive out fear from your life? We've been talking about fear in our series, and this question is sort of rattling inside of me. How exactly do we drive out fear in our lives? Because, of course, there's the famous passage in Scripture which talks about this, how perfect love drives out fear. 1 John, God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in them. And this is how love is made complete among us, so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. In this world, we're like Jesus. There's no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. So there's this idea here that perfect love drives out fear. It drives out our propensity, as we've talked about, to respond to fear with fight or flight, freeze or appease. But how exactly does perfect love drive out our fear response? And what I thought I'd do this morning, what I'd try, is two things. First, I want to try to give us a more concrete definition of what I think perfect love looks like. And then second, I want to name and showcase what I think are two of our particular cultural fears, and how I think the posture of love can help drive those out. So first, what exactly is perfect love? I mean, how do you make that idea concrete? Well, I want to highlight what I think is a prophetic understanding of perfect love. You see, in the book of Micah, we find a very interesting passage where Micah is reminding the people of Israel of the limits of sacrifice. And over the course of this year, we've talked about the logic of sacrifice, understanding the truth of how sacrifice works. It makes sense to a certain point, but of course, this idea comes to a head in the story of Abraham and Isaac. And you'll remember I made the audacious claim that perhaps Abraham misunderstood the voice of God when God asked him to sacrifice Isaac. And part of the reason for me thinking that is because in Scripture, you'll remember the Old Testament has this plurality of voices. In the Old Testament is what I would call the inspired story of Israel coming to know their God, but it's a process. It's a process. And so what happens is this prophetic tradition comes along and it challenges some of the earlier notions that the people have had of God. And Micah is asserting in this passage that God doesn't want or need sacrifice. And what he reveals to the people is what God actually does desire. And I think in this passage we get an interesting prophetic understanding of what perfect love looks like. Micah says this, there's some rhetorical questions here. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with a calf, a year old? No. Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? No. Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? No. He has told you, O mortal, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly with your God. I want to submit to you that Micah provides us here with perhaps an interesting and simple recipe for understanding what a perfect love looks like, the kind of perfect love that can drive out fear. Perfect love, you could say, is justice and humility and kindness. And in particular, I want to showcase how I think kindness and humility can play into a perfect love recipe that drives out fear. I've got lots of ideas about how justice and fear work, but that's going to have to wait for another time. But I want to focus in on kindness and humility. And what I want to do is I want to begin by naming some of our fears. You know, Richard Rohr says this, not everything can be fixed or cured, but it should be named properly. I like that. I think it's incredibly important when it comes to fear. And I truly believe we need to be brave enough to start talking about what we're afraid of. I think it's useless, it's unreflective to pretend we don't have fear. So naming our fears is important, not only in the name of honesty, but also because our fears can so easily be manipulated, can't they? I can confess, I don't think it's a stretch to say that preachers, teachers, politicians love to galvanize communities around fear. I mean, nothing brings a community together more than a mutual fear. And I mean, we're just, 10 weeks away from a provincial election? I'm telling you, watch the political rhetoric that we're about to hear. A lot of it is going to be based around what? Fear. Fear. We need to name our fears as an act of honesty, but also to safeguard us so that we know when we're being manipulated. And I want to contend this, that two of our particular cultural fears are this. We fear dependence, and we fear being ordinary. So how does kindness and humility speak to that and help drive out those fears? I was attending a conference in Atlanta with a group of six other guys, and we'd gone down to Atlanta, we drove down, and the conference was done, so we were driving home, and it was late. We left after the conference, so it was 9 before we got on the road, and 3 in the morning, we find ourselves in the middle of nowhere, Ohio. And we are trying to keep ourselves awake, trying to, keep conversation going, and I had been up in the front seat, but I was like, I gotta pass out for a bit, so I switched seats with someone. I was in the second row, just kind of nodding off, when all of a sudden I hear John, the driver, go, "Oh my goodness, a deer!" And I open my eyes to see a deer just poof, hit the front of the car, fly over the top of the car, and our van screeched to a halt on the side of the road. Oh my goodness, that was bad. Got out, is this thing still drivable? No, it wouldn't start again. So we are stuck on the road in the middle of Ohio. What do we do now? And remember the first guy that pulled over, he was drunk. Like, it was just bizarre, this kind of redneck Ohio guy. Hey, guys, looks like you got a problem here. I'm like, yeah, we got a problem here. It was funny. He stayed around chatting with us. Eventually, you could see police lights coming down the highway come to us. And the moment he saw them, he's like, well, it's been good chatting. I better get out of here. I'm like, well, okay. Best of luck there. Here we were on the side of the road, completely helpless. It was the strangest feeling as the police showed up. Like, oh, okay, you know, made sure the deer was dead. And then, like, so what do you guys want to do? I'm like, what do you mean? What do we want? Like, can we go home? Like, I don't know. He's like, well, this isn't going to be good. I don't have enough room to get all of you guys somewhere. And so we had to end up hitching a ride on the back of the tow truck. Two of us in the police car, four of us on the tow truck, pulled us into town. There's no motels there. We finally found some sketchy, I don't even know what it was. And walking in there, and they just, it was the most bizarre sequence, and we all slept on the floor, woke up the next day going, we still have no way to get home. I felt so helpless. And then began the series of calls, because there's six of us, right? So we don't just need a car. We need a friend with a van, you know, making the calls. Hey, how do you feel about driving to rural Ohio today? No, okay. So I must have gone through five people. Finally, somebody came and picked us up, but it was so helpless, felt so helpless standing on the side of the highway looking for a ride. And you know, it's an awful feeling. I don't know about you, but to know that you need others can be incredibly awkward to ask for help, can it? But in a moment like that, like, you know, you have no other choice. And I think most of us live our lives fearing those moments, desperately trying to avoid needing anyone. And not only do we fear it because it's an imposition, because it represents this loss of control. And, you know, I don't know about you, but it's weird when I think about the words I have the most trouble speaking, the words I have the most difficulty uttering are these: I need you. And it's bizarre because I have no problem telling the people I love that I love them. I don't even mind telling people I've wronged that I'm sorry. But saying those words, I need you, it makes my skin crawl. Because I can't stand feeling needy. And truth be told, I often resent people who I sense are needy. And my guess is I'm not alone, right? We're afraid of being dependent on others. We're afraid of others being dependent on us. And I don't think this should come as a surprise, because given the cultural setting we operate in, one of our great cultural myths is this, is that independence and individualism are virtues. And so culturally, we're constantly fed a stream of stories and opinions that sort of put down, that denigrate the idea of dependence. We look down on people who are dependent. We're afraid that we might become them. And so we pity the elderly, the disabled, don't want to be them. We sort of hide them from sight. Culturally, we idolize entrepreneurs. We demonize welfare recipients. We take our individualism so seriously that we often talk about individual rights and opinions, and rarely do we talk about duties and responsibilities. And the cultural idol of independence and individualism, it's seen everywhere as well in our faith. We tend to talk about faith as a personal decision that you make. Or we tend to speak of it in terms of our own personal relationship with God or Jesus. Or other people will say things like, I'm spiritual but not religious. And the implication of saying something like that is, I don't need a community to have faith. I can do this faith thing on my own. And even though that rubs against Scripture and thousands of years of tradition, we're taught and swim in this sea of independence and individualism. Yet the truth is this: we are dependent. We're dependent on God. He's the one in whom we live and move and have our being. We're dependent upon grace, like the song was about, to rescue, save us from karma. In terms of relationships with other peoples, our entire lives are dependent upon people. We would never reach our goals without others. Other people protect us from danger. They challenge us to grow. They challenge us to learn and mature. They share their wisdom with us. It's the only way we grow and mature. And so it's this dangerous deception to believe that ourselves to be individuals, somehow apart from others. The reality is this: I believe we are reliant on other people in ways we can only begin to comprehend. That's why I love the way the Apostle Paul frames the interconnectedness of church community. Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 12, "There are variety of gifts, but the same Spirit. And there are varieties of services, but the same Lord. And there are varieties of activities, but it's the same God who activates all of them in everyone. To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ." And from here, in the passage, Paul goes on to explain how it would be absurd and arrogant for the feet to say to the hand, "I don't need you." Or be silly for the ear to say to the eye, "I don't need you." Every part of the body is dependent and interdependent with each other. Each part exists to serve the whole. Growing up in church, we had a culture of special music. There was special music every Sunday. This was a big deal in my church. Like, there were bands and quartets, and they wore the same thing when they sang on Sunday mornings. And when Glory Bound Trio broke up, it was a big deal, like some big drama in the church there. And every week there was special music, and there was one guy in particular, Peter was his name, Peter Shoustra, and he always had a funny walk. He was always kind of stumbling. To be honest, he looked like he was drunk, but he was always kind of stumbling around, and he was one of the people who did special music, and you could always tell when Peter was going to sing, because he always would wear black sneakers with like these ill-fitting gray pants and a white shirt and a burgundy sports jacket. And so this particular Sunday, you could tell he was going to sing. And in church growing up, all of us youth, we always sat in the back section, like over there. And we were always getting in trouble. The preacher was always having to call us out. "Hey, kids, quiet over there." You know, we're always getting in trouble. But Peter Shoustra was singing this week. And remember, it was, "Rolled away, rolled away, rolled away. All the burdens of my heart rolled away." You know, it was a beautiful thing. But then as he went to get down from the stage after singing, he tripped and rolled onto the ground. And it was four steps onto the stage. So he, do-do-do-do-do. And just, it was perfect. He just sang about rolling away. And then he rolled down the stage, and all of us youth, we started laughing, just laughing. And why not? Publicly falling should be, I'm going to give you, if I ever fall up here, please laugh at me. It just deserves to be laughed at. It's funny. But I remember when I got home, my mother, "Were you one of the ones laughing?" So, well, it was kind of funny, to be honest. "You were laughing at Peter." Well, everyone else was. She said, "Do you know what Peter's story is?" I said, "I don't know." She said, "Well, Peter worked in a factory, and one time he had an accident, and his pinky toe got cut off. So he's lived his life without his pinky toe." I'm like, "Oh, what does that mean?" "The pinky toe is basically useless, except without it, your balance is off. You can hardly run or walk or skip without your pinky toe." I said, "So he lost his pinky toe and you were laughing at him." "Well, I'm sorry about that." But it drove home a point. It's like you have this pinky toe which looks like it's useless. And yet without that one little feature, this poor man's always stumbling around, falls off stage. It's like, it's fascinating that even the smallest body part is necessary for the whole. And I love this metaphor that Paul works with. It's powerful. Each of us has certain gifts or services and activities we do well, and we're given those things to serve others with. And why? Because we're dependent upon each other, whether we want to admit it or not. And that's terrifying. Because we hate the idea of needing others, being interdependent in community. And you know, it's so interesting, you see this reaction so often in church communities, the fear of being interdependent or operating community. Now, some of us freeze, right? Try to hide. If I go unnoticed, if I sit in the corner in the back, not that any of you are trying to hide this morning, but you know, this sort of, if I just get in and I get out really quick, no one will notice me, and I just, then I don't have to depend on anyone, they don't have to depend on me. And others of us, right, it's that flight instinct. I'm gonna get out of here. I don't want anything, anyone or anything to need something from me. And so the moment that community gets too demanding or too personal or challenging or not enough to my own individual taste, it's like, I'm out of here, I'm gonna run. Some of us just fight it with this attitude, right? Like, I don't need you. I don't need this. I don't need others. And you know, we can live under that illusion our whole life if we want to. You can run, you can hide, you can fight it. But at a certain point in our journey of faith and maturing, we have to wake up and realize not only do other people need you, but we need and rely on others as well. And it's a scary thing. But perfect love helps us drive out this fear. How so? In this case, I think kindness is the antidote to our fear of dependence. I think so often we think of kindness as simply being nice, right? Sure, acts of kindness are nice, but kindness is a virtue, and I'd say a posture in life that's much more than that. Kindness is a posture in life that reminds us we do not walk alone in this world, that our lives are built in relationship rather than isolated independence. And you know, I get it. Sometimes it's hard to think of kindness beyond being nice. Jonathan Whitehead, in his book Redeeming Fear, he does a great job dissecting how kindness can move us beyond our fear of dependence. And he does this by describing what he would call three distinct forms of communal kindness that go a long way in driving out our fear of independence. Verbal, social, and reputational postures of kindness. Verbal kindness, he simply describes as this. It's moving beyond greeting to blessing. In my interactions with others, when I'm talking to them, how can I not just greet people? How can I bless them? I've been thinking about this because I don't think that means that we need to necessarily carry around like a Celtic book of blessing and, here, let me read a Celtic blessing to you. I don't think it's necessarily that. But it's like, how do we bless others with our talk so it's not just hi, hello? How do we encourage others so that when they walk away, they feel blessed by that? Sometimes I think it's maybe even joking around. There's something incredibly affirming about being able to tease with people, being able to laugh. Sometimes it can be a small compliment. Sometimes it's simply a word of affirmation or acknowledgement. But moving beyond just speaking to one another, our desire to show kindness by blessing, or social kindness, he says, is our responsibility in interdependent community to specifically respond to hardships that other people face. As he talks about, the reality is this, throughout our life, we're all gonna face hardships. And there's nothing more kind and beautiful than a community that responds to hardships with food, clothing, shelter, loving relationships. And then he speaks of reputational kindness, which is, I think, one of the most challenging, the idea of trying to protect other people's reputation, increase their standing in society or community. This idea that we got your back. We're interdependent here, and so you shining and succeeding is us shining and succeeding, and we're going to have you covered here, and you don't need to worry about people maligning you behind your back. No, a community of people who want to protect and increase other people's reputation. And you know, I think the reason we fear dependence or being in community is because the gift of fear is that it keeps us hyper-vigilant about potential threats in the world, right? And dependence is a threat, a big one. Giving yourself to community can seriously burn you. Because here's the question, what if you involve yourself here and you never feel blessed? What if you invest in community here and find no one's there for you when the hardships of life do come? What if you invest in community only to find your reputation smeared? Or people have no interest in protecting you? Well, who wouldn't be scared of that? Why would anyone invest in that? Fear is a gift, and fear keeps us in this state of vigilance. It sets off alarm bells because community is a risk. And recognizing and living into dependence with others is a big risk. Make no mistake. It's a big risk. There are plenty of ways to feel threatened by that. And to be honest, as I've said before here, you will get burned here. I like to think of myself as the worst salesman for community. But I also hope I'm the most honest. Because we're human, and we're all trying our best. But if you're looking for perfect love, you probably won't find it here. But, what if you knew that we were trying for that, that our goal, that this was at least our intention? What if you knew as a community we really were trying to bless you, that everything that happens here on a Sunday morning or in Boomerang Groups is not just an accident, we don't just put this stuff together just for no reason, but it's to bless us? What if you knew that, you know what, we are going to try our best when life's hardships come along. We want to have your back. We want to be there for you. That's why we have a care team. What if you knew that in this community, hey, we really do want to protect each other's reputations, and we want to shine so that when you shine, we all shine. When I do well, you do well. When you do well, I do well. That we're all connected that way. I mean, the truth is this. You will never find that expressed perfectly here. In fact, a lot of times you won't even find that expressed well here. But if you knew a community like this desired to do and be that, I don't know about you, but that certainly starts to drive away the fear of community, our fear of dependence. Maybe it makes it worth the risk. And so if we can live with a posture of kindness, if we can commit as a community to kindness, what begins to happen is our desire to run or hide or fight against community, maybe our fear of dependence starts to get driven out.